What does it mean to be a Western yogi? How can someone who was born and raised in the West, who comes from a Judeo-Christian background, practice yoga and meditation in an authentic and genuine way? My name is Christopher Sartain, and this is the Western Yoga Podcast. Greetings, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Western Yoga Podcast. I'm currently in the southeastern United States, enjoying the last few days spent with family and friends, and then I'm heading back to Chile to our small ashram in the southern Andes in about a week. I want to talk today about the final verse of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika that discusses three proofs, you could say, or three pieces of evidence that they lay out, the author lays out, for enlightenment. Three things that, according to the Hatha Yoga Pradipika and the Hatha Yoga tradition, three characteristics that an enlightened person ought to have. Or you might even say, three characteristics that a teacher, a wise teacher or guru, should have. For those of you who don't know, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika was written in the 1300s, and it is a text from the Hatha Yoga tradition. Yoga, the history of yoga is divided up into five eras. Basically, you have the Vedic era, the first or oldest era, and then the pre-classical era, the classical era, the post-classical era, and the modern era. So those are the five eras of yoga history. And so this text, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, falls into the post-classical era, which is primarily concerned with two schools of yoga, Tantra and Hatha, because those were the two predominant schools or traditions of yoga during that time period. Oh, from about 300 AD or so until about 1900 AD. Those are the typical dates that we use for the post-classical period. 1900 and beyond is our current modern era of yoga. Perhaps in the future I'll do a brief rundown of the five different eras. But at any rate, today's discussion concerns the post-classical period. And again, this text comes out of that post-classical period and out of the Hatha Yoga movement. Hatha Yoga differs from classical yoga, or the yoga of Patanjali and the Yoga Sutras, let's say, in that it emphasizes the physical body, or it has its emphasis on some of the physical practices and some of the physiological changes that occur as a result of our yoga and meditation practice. And it also emphasizes purification, ritual purification, the shatkarmas, so-called, these techniques that we do to purify the physical body. And not just the physical body, but also the mind and the energetic layer, pranamaya kosha, and all of that. So energetic hygiene, mental hygiene, and especially physical hygiene, these were important aspects of the Hatha Yoga tradition. Because you see, in the post-classical period of yoga, this idea emerges that there's really no difference between the spiritual and physical, and it takes a more non-dual approach to spiritual philosophy, and in so doing it emphasizes the importance of the physical vessel that we inhabit, and it no longer views the physical as lesser than, inferior, mundane, not quite as important. We see that attitude represented in the classical yoga more so than in Tantra and Hatha. In Tantra and Hatha, the physical body or the vessel is given far more importance, and therefore there are more techniques and practices that emphasize the physical body, such as asana. The first listing of asanas or physical postures shows up in the Hatha Yoga texts for the first time. Many people are surprised to hear that many of the ancient yoga texts, like the Upanishads, the Bhagavad Gita, Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, etc., none of these texts include any mention of asanas or physical postures, except, of course, in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, Patanjali does mention the meditation posture, the meditation asana, or the posture that we ought to use strictly for meditation purposes, a seated posture. Okay? But the rest of the postures were not mentioned in any texts until the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, basically. And it gives a list of a few postures, not many. The Garuda Samhita and Shiva Samhita, two later Hatha Yoga texts, give more postures, and they list more asanas. But at any rate, we should understand that Hatha Yoga really introduced the importance of asanas for the first time in the history of yoga and many other practices, again, of hygiene and purification, known as Shatkarma. It's a wonderful text, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. I highly recommend everyone read it, especially if you're a Kriya yogi, because it's basically Kriya yoga. It's interesting that the modern Kriya teachers chose not to mention the Hatha Yoga texts as part of their sort of lexicon of important yoga texts. They emphasized instead the Bhagavad Gita and the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. But I would argue that the Hatha Yoga Pradipika is just as important, if not more important, for a Kriya yogi than the Gita or the Yoga Sutras. Now, that might sound almost sacrilegious for someone who is part of one of these large Kriya organizations. But if that's the case, then that means you're practicing a religion, which Kriya Yoga is not. So if anything ever sounds sacrilegious to you, that indicates that you are part of a religion or a religious movement. So I have no trouble, because I'm not part of any religious movement, I have no trouble including the Hatha Yoga Pradipika as a very important or key text for Kriya yogis to study and read. It's one of my favorite yoga texts, possibly my favorite, although I do really love Yoga Sutras of Patanjali. At any rate, in the final verse of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, we have a very interesting very interesting verse here. I'll read it. While the prana does not flow in the middle passage, while the bindu is not steadied by restraining the prana, while mind does not reflect spontaneous meditation, then those who speak of spiritual knowledge are only indulging in boastful and false tales. The context of this verse is, well, essentially the author is trying to give some characteristics or proofs of enlightenment, or characteristics that a spiritual teacher, a wise teacher, or guru should embody or possess. And so, essentially, there are three characteristics laid out in the final verse of this famous text. So, in other words, we are given three proofs of enlightenment. Three things that we can look at and verify in our own experience, and especially if we're looking for a teacher or a guru in our lives, then they ought to possess these three qualities. If not, it's probably a good time to find another guru or spiritual teacher to guide you. Okay? Now, this is not the be-all, end-all of enlightenment, these three characteristics. Again, Hatha Yoga had its emphasis on the sort of physiological manifestations of enlightenment, as it were. Notice it doesn't mention a kind and loving heart. A state of compassion and loving kindness. It doesn't mention anything about morality or ethics, having a high moral character, and all of that. So here it just gives us three sort of physiological proofs, as it were, of an enlightened being or of an enlightened teacher. So again, this is certainly not the be-all end-all of the enlightenment experience, but it does provide some indication for what an enlightened person might look like, or for what an enlightened person might be experiencing, you see. And the author says, otherwise, the person is just boasting, lying, in other words. If they do not possess these three qualities, they're full of it, according to the author of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika. By the way, this translation comes from Swami Mukti Bodhananda. It's an excellent translation, my favorite, and I highly recommend this particular translation. It is excellent, absolutely fantastic. I've read several translations. This is by far my favorite. And so I do highly, highly recommend this particular translation. Now, let's discuss these three proofs or characteristics or qualities of an enlightened being or teacher, according to the Pradipika. The first one should be familiar to all Kriya yogis. Probably not to most Hatha yogis, because for whatever reason, they don't really emphasize, well, the modern Hatha yogis, I should say. Let's distinguish that. They don't emphasize the Sushumna Nadi very much in the modern Hatha Yoga tradition, especially if you just attend a Hatha Yoga class at your local yoga studio or whatever. You'll hear no mention of the Sushumna Nadi or the Bindu or Samadhi or enlightenment or any of these things. Okay? But let's not get confused, and let's not confuse actual Hatha Yoga with the modern version that we see in yoga studios and everything. This is not the only yoga text, by the way, to mention the importance of the prana flowing in the Sushumna Nadi. And so this was deemed a very important event in the life of a yogi, when the Sushumna opens and is activated and the prana begins to flow inside the Sushumna Nadi. This is certainly taken as evidence for a Kriya yogi that they are on their way and that they have become a quote-unquote accomplished yogi to a certain extent. Once the Sushumna is open and the prana is flowing freely within the Sushumna Nadi, this certainly is evidence that one is on their way. Okay? Typically, in almost everyone, especially during our current yuga, I've talked in this podcast before about the fact that we are currently coming out of Kali Yuga, which is the darkest of all the yugas, dark age basically, and we're sort of on the cusp as we enter Dwapara Yuga, although we're still feeling the influences of Kali Yuga big time. And so during our current dark age, most people's Sushumna Nadis are completely closed and inactive. Of course, most people are not aware of this, but it is absolutely the case. And so when one is able to activate their Sushumna, this is quite rare in our current age. But it's real. It absolutely happens. And when the Sushumna Nadi is opened, when it is activated, one can feel the flow of prana inside the Sushumna Nadi, especially during the practice of Kriya Pranayama, which in the ancient texts was known as Kavali Pranayama. But for whatever reason, Lahiri Mahashaya, Sri Yukteswar, Paramahansa Yogananda started calling it Kriya Pranayama. Okay? But it's the same technique as the Kavali Pranayama as it was known in more ancient times, okay? But they're the same technique, the same practice. At any rate, once one becomes a, you know, so-called accomplished yogi, one does begin to feel this flow of prana inside the Sushumna Nadi, not only during their Kriya Pranayama practice, although it is more easily noticeable or observable during that practice, but one will begin to feel this flow in their normal day-to-day activities. Okay? This is an indication that the Kundalini process is well underway and is active in one's being. Part of the Kundalini process includes physical changes and energetic changes and mental changes. All these changes occur as part of the Kundalini process. Okay? And so that's essentially what the Kundalini process is. It's this, Kundalini is this intelligent force that catalyzes these changes. This sort of alchemical process, if you will. One of the most important changes that occurs is the opening of the Sushumna Nadi, which is the central energetic channel in your astral layer, your energetic layer, known as the Pranamaya Kosha in the yoga tradition. Once the Sushumna Nadi, this central channel, is open, and by the way, it, for those of you that don't know, the Sushumna Nadi sort of follows the course of the human spine. It is curved at the top. It goes kind of over the head, really inside the head, just a bit in the top of the brain, and then it ends in the Agna Chakra, which is the third eye chakra, sort of located in the forehead or the frontal lobes of the brain. Okay? And it follows the sort of root, as it were, or course of the human spine, is located along the human spine. Sometimes it is referred to as the astral spine. Okay? Now, this Sushumna Nadi connects all of the chakras, so it's kind of like the central pathway or highway of the chakras, as it connects all of the chakras and flows through the chakras. Now, when this channel is open and active, and the prana is flowing freely in the Sushumna Nadi, several things begin to happen. For one, you begin to cleanse and purify the karma that is stored in the chakras. In the yoga philosophy, it is believed that we store karma, or samskaras, karmic seeds, really, in the chakras. Okay? And so, as you begin to consciously, intentionally draw the prana into the spine as it's flowing inside the Sushumna Nadi, you know, we're able to essentially purify and clean the samskaras, or karmic seeds, existing inside the chakras. So you can think of it as sort of like a energy bath, or an energy shower, a prana shower. And so it's a form of sort of like energetic hygiene and karmic hygiene. And so we do begin to burn off some of those karmic seeds, and we are able to draw the prana up into the higher chakras, for real. People talk about, oh, bringing your prana to the higher chakras with intention. Well, that helps, certainly. Part of it is intention and will and concentration and all of that. Sure. But you're not really able to draw nearly as much prana into those higher chakras when your Sushumna Nadi is closed. This is certainly true. And so as that Sushumna Nadi begins to open, and as it sort of becomes more and more active, the prana is able to flow up into the higher chakras far more easily, and you're able to bring far more prana to those higher chakras, far more attention to those higher chakras. And those chakras are thusly activated, and one is able to experience higher states of super consciousness as the prana is drawn into the higher chakras. Okay? And so as part of this Kundalini process, the Sushumna Nadi opens up, becomes active, is no longer dormant and closed, and one is able to draw that prana up into up into the higher chakras to experience more enlightened states of consciousness and being. This does occur. This is true. This is a verifiable, observable fact for anyone as they activate their Sushumna. Now, Sushumna activation typically takes a while. There's a popular Kriya Yogi who I know, who in a recent talk said that it took about 2 years of practicing Kriya Pranayama daily, many rounds daily, for his Sushumna Nadi to open and activate. There are people who practice for a decade or more and are unable to open and activate their Sushumna Nadi. I don't completely understand it. Probably no one does. I was very fortunate and blessed that, although I had done a lot of preparation, but when I was initiated into Kriya Yoga by my spiritual teacher, Roy Eugene Davis, the first time I practiced Kriya Pranayama, right after I had learned it, immediately felt the flow of prana in my Sushumna Nadi. But, and I thought that perhaps that was common, but speaking with my teacher later on, I was informed that this was very uncommon and incredibly rare, actually. Okay? So, if you have been practicing yoga for a long time, you've been doing different pranayama techniques, meditating and all this, but you still don't feel the prana flowing inside your Sushumna, don't worry, that's normal. So don't panic or anything and think there's something wrong with you or whatever. It just takes time. It just takes time. And at any rate, so we want to activate the Sushumna Nadi. We want to open the Sushumna Nadi so that the prana flows freely inside the Sushumna. Okay? So this is one characteristic. According to this ancient text, this is one characteristic of enlightened consciousness. And it is something that an enlightened being should possess, this characteristic, this quality. Okay? And it certainly is evidence that the Kundalini process is well underway and the yogi. Okay? So, it does act as a sort of energetic hygiene. It burns off karma or karmic seeds. And it allows us to draw the prana up into the higher chakras, resulting in the activation of those chakras, as well as elevated states of consciousness. Okay? Now, the second characteristic is a little more difficult to interpret, but essentially, when the author speaks of the Bindu, they're talking about this point in the brain, this tiny little space within the brain that produces soma nectar. So this is the part of our brain that produces soma, or amrita, nectar, ambrosia, okay? I won't spend too much time discussing soma because I'll do an entire podcast episode in the future at some point discussing soma, but it's absolutely real, and it is the so-called sacred oil that is spoken of in other traditions. And so there were other traditions, esoteric traditions, that did know about this sacred oil that the brain produces. It was not exclusive to the yoga tradition, in other words. Nothing is, by the way. you know, as you branch out and you start to study other esoteric metaphysical systems, you do begin to notice that ancient knowledge was passed down not only to yogis in India, but to different peoples and different parts of the world. Christ, for example, the word, comes from the Greek Christos, which essentially means one who has been anointed by the sacred oil. Okay? And they were not talking about olive oil or grapeseed oil or anything like that. They were referring to this soma nectar. Okay? At any rate, this is a real nectar produced in the brain that drips down into the mouth and mixes with saliva, and then you're able to swallow that nectar. And if your digestive fires, the Agni, does not burn it up, then this oil converts into amrita or ambrosia in the rest of the body and can be experienced by yogis. Okay? And it feels like a sort of subtle flow of ecstasy in the body. It gets to the point where you can literally feel it in like every cell of the body. And it has a sort of nutritive effect and a healing effect. And it literally begins to spiritualize the physical body. That was the terminology that Yogananda used, is that the body becomes spiritualized by the amrita. And so it's very difficult to describe the sensations associated with soma and amrita, but you do have the you do have the experience that, okay, this is sort of taking this whole thing to another level. And so it's a very important part of the Kundalini process once the brain begins to produce soma nectar. And so in the Pradipika and in other yoga texts, it discusses the need to have the prana flowing freely in the Sushumna Nadi, and then to be able to still the prana in the head. We have to still the prana in the head. Okay? And so essentially that means that you want to draw the prana up into the head and leave it there in a motionless, still state. This, in turn, activates the bindu, which then begins to produce soma nectar, which then drips into the mouth, mixes with saliva, and is swallowed. And with time, typically, this soma begins to convert into amrita, or this sort of spiritual ambrosia in the rest of the body, which again has a sort of healing effect. It slows the aging process quite a bit and is very nutritive. And we have the sense that I'm changing. You know, my body is changing, my energetic body is changing, my brain is changing, my nervous system is changing. And so the soma or amrita is responsible for a lot of the important changes that occur in the body as a result of the kundalini process. Okay? So here we see that the Sushumna should be open, should be active, the prana should be flowing freely in the Sushumna Nadi. And one should be able to still the prana in the head, activate the bindu, and produce soma regularly. This is the interpretation of what is being said in this verse. Okay? There are other verses in the Pradipika that talk a lot more about soma and all of that. So again, I encourage you to read the text. It's excellent. There's a lot of esoteric and metaphysical knowledge and wisdom contained in the verses of the Pradipika. Okay? So, again, one's Sushumna Nadi should be completely open and active. The prana should be flowing freely inside the Sushumna Nadi. One should be able to still the prana in the head, activating the bindu, so that soma nectar is produced regularly and frequently. Okay? Now, the third characteristic or quality of an enlightened being, according to this text, is to be able to achieve superconscious states at will. Okay? Meaning that it does not require a great deal of effort and 2 hours of sadhana and meditation practice to be able to experience a superconscious state. In other words, one has already done all of the preparatory work, usually for decades, and one is able to experience these superconscious states at will, without the need to do a long, arduous sadhana. Because they've already done decades worth of sadhana, you see. So they've done all the preparatory work, and they've reached a stage, not a state, a stage of awakening in which they are able to experience superconsciousness at will. Okay? Now, of the three characteristics listed, this is by far the most important one. Because really, why are we doing all these things? You know, why do we care that our Sushumna Nadi is active, that the prana is flowing in there, that the bindu, you know, what's the point of all this? Well, the point of all this is to ensure that all of the appropriate changes have occurred that will allow for the experience of frequent superconscious states. So that eventually, with time, we are able to experience superconscious states frequently. Of course, the ultimate goal, or purpose, or objective of our practice and our spiritual path is a sort of stage of permanent superconsciousness or self-knowing. I'll be honest, I don't know that I've ever met anyone who's experiencing a permanent stage of superconsciousness and self-knowing. That doesn't mean that it's impossible. In our current yuga, it's challenging, to say the least, okay? And it depends, of course, on your situation, your circumstances, you know, what does your life look like, what does your lifestyle look like, you know, and all of that. But personally, I've never met anyone who's in a permanent stage of superconsciousness. In other words, who never reverts back to identification with the body, the ego, the mind, and all of that. Who is constantly, permanently superconscious. Never identified with any facet of the false self. I've never met anyone like that. They probably exist, even in our current yuga. There might be a few on the planet right now. It's possible. Fully liberated, enlightened masters. I hold it open as a possibility. I would say it's incredibly rare, but it's possible. Anything is possible. You know, Yogananda said that we should erase the word impossible from our mind, and or to never allow the word impossible to enter our mind, something like that. I don't remember the exact quote. But yeah, sure, anything is possible. Okay? Anything is possible. And so to summarize this verse, essentially, the author of the Hatha Yoga Pradipika is essentially saying that there are three characteristics that any enlightened being or enlightened teacher ought to possess. If not, they're just talking nonsense. And these are an open and active Sushumna Nadi with the prana flowing freely inside the Sushumna. The stilling of the prana in the head resulting in the activation of soma production in the brain. And the capacity to experience superconscious states at will. If you can find a teacher like that, you're well on your way. But again, these three characteristics or qualities are certainly not the be-all end-all of the enlightenment experience. You might first also want to make sure that your teacher is compassionate, loving, kind, humble, not judgmental, not critical. Okay, these are also incredibly important qualities for a spiritual teacher to possess. Sometimes I think we get a little too fixated on some of the physical proofs or physiological proofs or energetic proofs, and we don't place enough emphasis on things like kindness, acceptance, tolerance, having a non-judgmental attitude, being open and caring and loving and compassionate and wise and all these things. But it's an interesting verse to discuss from a more physiological vantage point. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Please share the podcast with like-minded individuals. Lots of love. Namaste.